Can everybody hear okay? So tonight the topic is compassion fatigue and burnout and mindfulness as an antidote. And the way the evening's going to go is I'm going to give a little bit of framework up front, and then you'll have a little bit of time to break into dyads or triads or however it sorts itself out. And then I'll share some more thoughts, and then there'll be some time for question and answer. So I want you all to take a moment and think about your various roles as caregivers. And we'll start with the more common ones, so therapists, nurses, physicians, teachers, parents, grandparents, aunties and uncles, sisters and brothers, caring for pets or gardens or the planet or a particular cause. So just take a moment and think of your various hats that you wear as a caregiver. And I forgot to mention children of aging parents. And just notice what arises as you ponder your various roles. And then I want you to take a moment and ponder what causes burnout or compassion fatigue for you personally and for people in general. So just pondering both the internal habits and the external structures that can lead to compassion fatigue and burnout. And when you start to look at the research on compassion fatigue and burnout, people talk about all sorts of things that contribute to these phenomena. Where you exist in an organizational hierarchy, how that hierarchy is run, what is your role, what are the external expectations, how communication's handled in a particular setting. And a lot of those are external, and we don't have a lot of say or control or choice about them. When I look at the various lists on compassion fatigue and burnout, there are some things that are within our control, or at least slightly more within our control. And those have to do with our own social support. So you might ponder for a moment your current social support. And our individual mental health, and you are all already to be congratulated, because if you're here, you're tending to your individual mental health. And our own expectations and reactions. And part of mindfulness is being aware of our own sometimes fairly grand expectations and sometimes not so helpful reactions when we're caring for someone. So just pondering that for a moment. And most of the data, when you look at data on mindfulness and compassion fatigue and burnout, comes from the healthcare professions, at least so far. So that's nurses, physicians, therapists, and actually some recent research as well in the military care providers. So the people who are caring for the people who are in combat, and the care providers may be in combat or they may be caring for them when they return home. And that data actually tells us that the practice of mindfulness, and often these are done in the standard 8-week MBSR format when you're looking at a research study. So many of you, a couple of you raised your hands for first time here, and many of you I know have been here a long time and sitting and practicing a long time. So I want you to know that you're reaping benefits, because what we know about people who practice mindfulness even for 8 weeks, which is really not that long, is that it decreases burnout and distress. It decreases emotional exhaustion, depersonalization and drowsiness. And my new favorite research finding, I just got to hear Sarah Lazar speak at the Mindfulness in Education Conference in Boston, is it decreases activity in the amygdala. And the amygdala is that part of our brain that does fight or flight. And again, it was a short study, 8 weeks, and to be able to see that on fMRI is just, I don't know, it's one of the coolest things on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, to say that this practice, and a short amount of this practice, changes the way our brain responds to stress. The other data is that mindfulness increases our adaptation to stress and our sense of relatedness. So when we're caring for someone, it increases our satisfaction with life and our sense of personal accomplishment. And another fMRI one, not as recent, the activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is the area of our brains that's associated with positive emotion. And there's some studies showing that it increases compassion and empathy. And the other than Sarah's study, the nicest recent study was published in JAMA in September by a friend and colleague of mine, Mick Krasner, who taught mindfulness for 8 weeks to physicians, and showing that they had increases in compassion and empathy. They felt more connected and effective with their patients. They felt like they were more able to tolerate difficult situations with their patients. And so it's a very powerful practice. And if that's not motivation enough, now I'm going to ask you to perhaps get into groups of two or three. And if you're feeling brave enough, perhaps not with your best friend or significant other, and for a few minutes talk about those places that we don't sometimes talk about so much, which is what we know about our own habits that create compassion fatigue and burnout. What is it that we do, and you can pick your top three or your top five, that make you more likely to burn out or get fatigued and be slightly less compassionate than you would otherwise prefer to be. So if you can just group up, and I'll let you talk for probably 10 minutes so that each person has enough time, and then we'll come back together and we'll discuss what you've discovered. So this is your time to share what you discovered, and then if you haven't covered my top 10, I'll cover mine when we're done. So who wants to share something? And I'll repeat it so that you can hear and the people on the recording can hear. Go ahead.
Well, in our group, we all three have the problem of knowing setting boundaries.
Okay, setting boundaries. Sound familiar? Any people? Okay, and we can talk about that. How about for other people? In the back.
Could you please define the compassion between?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the term is used, and I don't know that even when I read the literature, it's very well defined. But I think I'll define it how I would define it personally, those places where part of us really is committed to being there and being of service, and some other part of us is closed down or gone away, checked out, or in some ways maybe overdoing, and we can talk about that too, but doing in a way that's disconnected. So we may be doing the motions, but we're not there. So I think we can do it both ways. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, someone over here had their hand up.
I was going to say in our group we talked about the necessity to have time for ourselves too, whether it be meditation or other things.
So self-care. Go ahead.
So some things, different things came up, but one of them was asking me rather in a situation when you face with a kid that they're not necessarily be having, rather than if they were saying, you know, you need to have a deep condition. But also, the more you meditate when you're connected to them, the more you're able to establish something and come back to them.
Okay, so the I'm going to paraphrase. You can help me if I get it wrong. But that when you're reacting, particularly to something unpleasant, and in the group it was discussed that meditation and being able to stay with your emotions was grounding. Close enough? There were a couple more.
We talked about being drawn into the situation emotionally and how that can be a problem. We can be fearful or being drawn into the situation emotionally. So it seems like being mindfully compassionate could help deal with the situation better so that you don't withdraw or you don't put yourself in the too much of the suffering.
Right, so finding that middle place between being over-invested and distant, and that takes practice and attention. Okay, someone was over here, I think.
Recognizing that perhaps I have expectations of wanting to be acknowledged for my effort.
Yeah, so... what Byron Katie would call seeking love, approval, and appreciation. One of my favorites. What else?
Wanting to see results.
Yeah. Attachment to outcome. Go ahead.
Trying to fix something.
Yeah. Yeah, so the distinction of knowing when we're fixing, and as a physician, I'm all for fixing what can be fixed. And there's a whole lot that can't be fixed. So being able to know the difference and be present with that. Go ahead.
Knowing that the feelings, anger, sadness are yours and not created by the person itself.
Okay, so being responsible for your feelings. Anything else? Go ahead.
Approaching situations with a frame of mind that some response is being demanded of you rather than clearly given by you.
Right. So it's not only our own expectations, but our sense of other people's expectations. And that goes back a little bit to the boundary issue, which we discussed in our group as well. What else?
You're doing something out of a sense of obligation rather than something for your passion.
Yeah. So, and
So, and I was listening to David White, the poet, talking about that, and his friends being involved in Canelos and stuff, and he found that he was really there for when his center was really put out the effort.
Right, and it helps to be clear about what we're passionate about and what our job with a capital J is, and at the same time to hold it loosely, because what we think we're passionate about or what we think our job is may not actually be in that moment our job. And, you know, if in the moment what you're doing is something that you're not particularly passionate about, it's not that you're going to jump up and down and say, yippee, yahoo. And can you bring some connection to it, even if it's not, you know, the passion with a capital P? What else?
It reminds me of a lot of meditators work with hospice care, and I wonder why, and somebody stated it beautifully, when you work with the dying, you can't fix it. So you are just there, and you've got to be there with whatever's happening, but you know up front, you're not going to be able to fix it.
Yeah.
I thought that was so stunning.
Well, and hospice is very here and now. And I think people who do that work, it keeps you in the here and now, because you realize the here and now is brief. What else?
This may go to a little bit on those boundaries and expectations, but the idea that you can't do everything yourself, and taking on more than you can actually shoulder.
Right.
Not willing to ask for help or delegate or draw a line for yourself, or without yourself, bring yourself up.
Yeah, overcommitting, and the interesting practice there is to see what's driving the overcommitment, or what's driving the difficulty with the boundaries. Do people have other ones? Do we cover most of them? So I'm just going to, you know, my list is not that different than yours, but I'll share it with you just, and a lot of it will be reiterating or expanding on what you've already said. So one thing is people talked about neglecting themselves or not making time for themselves, and I think the most simple and obvious way that we do that is by neglecting our bodies. Getting so caught up in our to-do list of whatever it happens to be that we're not eating well, we're not sleeping well, we're not practicing, we're not moving our bodies. And there's something about the more habitual that becomes, the more we're in our heads, and it has a self-perpetuating quality to it. When we neglect or deny the information that our body's giving us, and you know, we all know that place, even if it's just the quiet sighing, ugh, when someone asks for that one last, you know, what really is kind of the last straw. And we disregard it all the time. I mean, there's something in there that says that was the last straw, and we ignore it, and then we wonder why we're toast. Then we're cross. Cross would be an understatement sometimes, right? Someone over here had talked about the distinction, what I called the distinction between doing and being. So. We get so lost in the doing, even if the doing seems like a really good idea, you know, doing someone's laundry or picking up their groceries or that we're not really there for them or for us anymore, and we forget the value of being. I mean, and I mean all of us in this room, but I mean it also as a culture. You know, even the thing of, what did you do today? You know, the question that we ask people all the time. You know, and we don't say, I sat and befriended myself, or I sat and befriended my friend. Ego versus service, and I think many of you have probably read Rachel Naomi Remen's thing on the distinction between helping and service. But when we do it from ego, when we're looking for love, approval, and appreciation, when we think we're the ones who's doing it at all, there's an efforting that's underneath that. Like there's a certain franticness underneath that isn't of service. And service feels, to me, service has a distinct feel, and it's open, and the energy comes as it's needed, but there's not that scrambly feeling to it when I'm rooted in being and in service. Good intentions gone astray. We can start in service. We can start in service all the time, and we can find our passion and our, you know, our job with a capital J, and then we get into the ego again, and we get into fixing, and sometimes we get into being right. All of a sudden, that thing that started in being and in service gets corrupted somehow. And one of the important things is to find that inflection point. And one of the ways we find that inflection point is by paying attention to our body, because the doing and the fixing has that scrambly, striving feeling to it. Arrogance, one of my personal favorites. Thinking we know how it should go. And, you know, how someone should eat, live their life, deal with their cat, deal with their children, deal with their spouse. Like, who says we know? And often it's us, and we say it often. But you know, noticing where we argue with what's so, you know. My father-in-law is coming to mind because his eating habits are less than healthy, and now I'll have to tell him he can listen to the audio tape. But the more we suggest, tease, admonish, like kind of the more stubborn he gets. And, you know, and we so often think that we know how it should go. And if we can just catch ourselves and have a sense of humor about that. You were going to say something.
Yeah, sometimes I think we do know what should happen. But in that case, I think you have to be willing to let the person crash die.
Yeah, and there is... So she said sometimes we do know. And sometimes there are roles where whether we know or not, it's kind of our job to take a good, solid shot at it. I mean, I'm parenting now a 12-year-old boy and a 10-year-old girl, and I mean, whether I know or not in the moment, I have to take my best guess sometimes. There are places where we definitely hold that responsibility, and I'm not in any way suggesting that we shirk it, but at the same time, I'm suggesting that we be really humble about our assumptions. And sometimes, even those places where someone needs to crash and burn, like we'd love to spare them that if we could, and we try, and sometimes we can't, and who's to say that they're not, that really what they need at that moment isn't to crash and burn, and that's not easy or pleasant or fun, and sometimes it's what's happening. Even if in our arrogance we think it should go otherwise. The next one I wrote was addiction. And it's all those things that we're addicted to. Love, approval, and appreciation. Outcomes. Sometimes we're caregiving because we want to be in that drama, because it's easier to be in that drama than over here in our own lives. But, you know, and we know when we're telling, like there's a certain place for me where I know when I'm telling a story that it's far enough away that it's become a story, like it's not what's happening right now, but it's a good story, so I keep telling it for a while. And so I wanted to say something about the boundaries, because that came up a lot. And I have a longtime mentor, actually a 20 years mentor, and one of the gifts she has given me is what she calls beautiful no. And the thing about beautiful no is when someone makes a request of us, even if it's us making a request of us, we can stop, and Sharon's going to talk about the pause next week, so we can pause and listen simply for the truth of our answer. And what I've learned about beautiful no, even though sometimes honestly it's disappointing to me, and sometimes it's disappointing to other people, or at least I think it is that when I say beautiful no, what it leaves room for is beautiful yes. But if I say yes to those things that are truly no, then when the joyful, passionate yes comes, I'm booked. And I can't say yes to that one, especially I was talking before we started tonight. When I'm in a teaching cycle, my commitment to my family is that I am only out of the house one night a week, and that's a more or less thing. It doesn't always work out quite like that. So, you know, if I've booked that yes, there's a lot of no's that come after that. And so it's that moment by moment choice. And I'm trying to think. I think there's a book I read recently where someone's mother's in the hospital and they want whatever the yellow pants with the white flowers, and they absolutely have to have them right now. And it's the last straw for the woman, and she says no, and the mother kind of gives her grief, you know, I'm on my deathbed, how can you deny me, blah blah blah, and it's all fine, and she doesn't really need the yellow pants with the white flowers right then. And you know, we make up how much someone needs it, or they make it up and we believe it. But this practice of beautiful, no, and practice with the little things first. Honey, do you want Chinese? No. You know, I want to stay home. Or I really want Italian. I mean, you know, so that you build that muscle for those times when you need it. And then be prepared to be mystified and pleasantly surprised by the beautiful yes. I mean, the thing that you so think you don't want to do. Will you keep the fourth grade guinea pig over winter break? Or, you know, whatever it is, you know, some of those things, you know, when, you know, it's your turn to clean up the vomit at 3 a.m, you know, there can be beautiful yes to that. And it doesn't come if we're completely depleted. So, you know, play with that. If you're going to take one thing home to play with and practice with, play with beautiful no. And the last thing I want to say, which comes back kind of to the first thing that was said and the first thing that I said, which is when I was in medical school, I had a yoga teacher who very wisely said, fill your cup first so you can overflow to others. And a lot of us, our cups are the last ones that we fill. So we have only a few minutes, but we can have a few minutes of questions or responses or objections or brilliant epiphanies or whatever people want to share. Go ahead.
One of the things that I found is really freeing is to say no without making the excuse to say no. That really frees you up.
Yeah. So she's saying no without an excuse, and that's part of beautiful no, like no defense, no justification. I would if I could, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, not this time, thank you and no. Somewhere someone had, and I think you could probably Google it, like 25 ways to say no. I mean, and none of them are, have justifications. But just thank you and no. Go ahead.
The thing I have found with saying no is things I want to say no to when I'm tired are the open-ended things, because that draws you right into all that energy that never gets to regenerate. And so if you say no, but I wouldn't have to do this, and this is something finite that you can see what you're doing, and so you can still be have the feeling of being comfortable without that open-ended.
Right. So being specific about what we say yes to and what we say no to. I won't do it indefinitely, but I'll do it this week, or I'll do it every fourth week, or whatever it is. Go ahead. It'll come back. Couple more, just so she has a chance to remember. You've got it now.
It isn't loving to wear yourself out for everyone. And it isn't loving to keep your body in a kind of bad way. And I think a lot of people really resist that because it's better to give than receive. And I'm just saying that it's better to receive than give.
Yeah, and my sense is that there's, I notice I have hesitate. Because it's a place where I get stuck, good, bad, better, worse, right, wrong. My sense is that if we're paying attention, they happen naturally. There's an ebb and a flow. And it's today is a giving day, or not even today, but this 5 minutes is a giving time, and then it's a receiving time. And if we're attentive enough, there is there is a balance that happens, and we can when it's required of us, we can, you know, that giving place can go on for quite a period of time, and we can build some receiving into that if we're wise enough and if there's space. But you know, in real crises, there's something there that allows for that, and then we need to replenish afterwards. And I don't know, you know, it's like in this moment it's better to give, and in this moment it's better to receive, and being curious about it. And also a part of how we learn is by doing that overcommitting thing. Oh my gosh, what was I thinking? Why did I raise my hand and say I bring brownies on Thursday? And really being curious about what was underneath that, and sometimes being willing to go back and say, you know what? I said I'd bring brownies and I realize it's not gonna work for me, so can, you know, somebody else bail me out and I'll do it next time. What else? So there's one last thought that you reminded me of, which is when we have compassion fatigue for ourselves, which is this place where we don't love and care for ourselves, and just noticing how it is that we do that when we do that. Other people are more important. The to-do list is more important. You know, having clean house and matching socks are more important. But really having some curiosity about what we put ahead of filling our cup so that we can overflow to others. So I'll be in the back for questions if anybody wants.